From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When two top scholars from Harvard and the University of Chicago, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, lobbed a grenade into the U.S. foreign policy debate, they got the explosion they asked for. They say the U.S. has harmed its own national interest because it has listened too closely to a hardline pro-Israel lobby. This hour, On Point, Walt and Mearsheimer make their case on America, its Israel lobby, and its policy in the Middle East. You can join the conversation. When the smoke clears from this dust-up, will we be any the wiser? Is there a better way for the U.S. in the Middle East? Is there a better way to talk about it? And do you hear defamation or illumination in the analysis of Walt and Mearsheimer? Is the U.S. too close to Israel? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We will hear from these two scholars in this hour. We will hear from you, and we will hear from two top American diplomats, Dennis Ross and Aaron David Miller, who have their own views of the critique and reality of U.S.-Israel ties. Stephen Walt is a professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. John Mearsheimer is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. They are co-authors of the new book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Both join us from Washington, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Nice to be here, Tom.
John Mearsheimer, let me come first to you. Give us the core arguments of the case you make in the Israel lobby.
Well, the basic argument, Tom, is that there is this powerful lobby in the United States that is concerned with pushing American foreign policy in directions that are favorable to Israel. It's important to emphasize that we're not arguing that this lobby is pushing on purpose American policy in ways that are detrimental to the United States. That's not our argument. But it's mainly concerned with pushing American foreign policy in ways that support Israel. That's the first part of the argument. And the second part of the argument is that we believe that American foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, is misguided and not in the American national interest, and this is due largely to the force of the lobby.
Stephen Walt, you make the case that there is not, or perhaps no longer, a strategic or moral, your words, rationale for the very deep U.S. relationship with Israel. Let's hear that argument.
Well, we say in the book that we believe there's a strong moral case for Israel's existence, and we believe the United States should come to Israel's aid if its survival were ever in jeopardy. The good news there is its survival is not in jeopardy, but we believe there isn't a strong strategic argument for backing Israel unconditionally, that Israel is in fact not much of a strategic asset to the United States, especially now that there's no Cold War to wage, and especially given the problems the United States has throughout the Middle East. Moreover, given the prolonged occupation in the West Bank and more recently or previously in Gaza and Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, there is no compelling moral case for giving Israel the kind of unconditional backing that the United States has provided over the years. So again, we think there's a moral case for Israel's existence, and we actually support the existence of the state of Israel quite strongly, but we don't think American policy towards Israel or more broadly in the Middle East should be so unconditional given the fact that it's now increasingly a strategic liability and there's no compelling moral case for unconditional support.
You write that, quoting you here, many policies pursued on Israel's behalf now jeopardize U.S. national security. That's your assessment. Yet you say those policies go on because of the Israel lobby. John Mearsheimer, how do you define or describe the Israel lobby? That's a big, broad, to my mind, ambiguous term.
Well, we define the lobby as a loose coalition of individuals and groups that actively work to push American foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. We don't define it as a Jewish lobby because the fact of the matter is that not all Jews are deeply committed to Israel, and in no way could you argue that all Jews are part of the lobby. Furthermore, there is an important non-Jewish element in the lobby. A good number of the neoconservatives in the lobby are not Jewish, and the Christian Zionists, of course, are one of the key constituencies in the lobby. So our basic argument is that you have this loose coalition. There are no card-carrying members. There are no There's no central leadership.
Loose coalition, you know, like what? Who? Where?
Tom, a couple things. It would be, first of all, groups like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, Christian Zionist groups like Christians United for Israel. There are also a wide array of think tanks, the American Enterprise Institute, very strongly pro-Israel, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy as well, which was created to present sort of pro-Israel research analyses. And the thing to understand here is, like all other special interest groups, this special interest group has many components, both formal lobbying groups, but also supporting institutions that are designed to try and sell essentially the same message. And we make it very clear that what the, quote, Israel lobby, unquote, is doing is as American as apple pie. It's just another special interest group like many other special interest groups, the ARP, the National Rifle Association, the Farm Lobby. There's nothing illegitimate about its activities at all.
This is not a conspiracy or a cabal. Many of our critics misrepresent our argument, Tom, by saying that we're talking about the lobby as if it were some nefarious force, some cabal, something along the lines of what you see in the infamous Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But nothing could be further from the truth. This is good old-fashioned interest group politics. The lobby is just a powerful interest group that has a powerful influence on American foreign policy in the Middle East.
Help me understand the politics of the Israel lobby as you see it. John Mearsheimer, you said you're not talking about the American Jewish community in general because, to quote you, you said not all Jews are committed to Israel. Many certainly are, but are you saying, well, I guess I like you to define, what are the politics of the Israel lobby, if it's possible to characterize them, and it's not the same as American Jewry at large?
Well, if you look at public opinion polls within the American Jewish community, what you see is that roughly one-third of American Jews are deeply committed to Israel. Another one-third are committed, but not deeply committed, and roughly one-third feels no powerful allegiance to Israel and does very little to promote Israel's interests in the United States. So you see a very variegated picture. At the same time, if you look at organizations like the Christians United for Israel, John Higgy's organization, you see that there's a deep-seated commitment to the state of Israel and the policies that it's pursuing within that organization and among many Christian Zionists. Mm. So what you have here is a lobby that is not comprised solely of Jews or comprised of all Jews.
Stephen Walt, is commitment to Israel the hallmark of what you would call members of the Israel lobby, or is it a particular kind of commitment, a particular vision of commitment to Israel?
I'd say a couple things. It's the political agenda, as John was implying, the political agenda that defines the lobby, not ethnicity or religion. And it's important to note that different groups that we would call part of the lobby don't agree on all issues. There are some very hardline groups that believe, for example, that Israel should control all of the occupied territories in perpetuity. There are other groups and individuals within the lobby who favor a two-state solution and would like to see something like that happen. I think the unifying theme in all of these organizations is that they believe the United States and Israel should have a special relationship that's very different than the American relationship with other democracies, and in a sense that the United States should continue to back Israel no matter what Israel does. So many of the key organizations in the lobby, for example, strongly supported Israel last year during the war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, even though Israel's policy was both strategically foolish, as many Israelis now realize, and also violated a number of laws of war, yet and was widely criticized in other democracies around the world. But here in the United States, of course, the key organizations in the lobby wanted the United States to back Israel, even though its policies weren't good for us, and in fact were not good for Israel either.
We're going to hear voices with a critical view of your research and a very different view of this relationship. But as you see it, John Mearsheimer, what's the downside of the influence of what you call the Israel lobby? As you say, there are many lobbies in this country, and no small number of them related to countries of origin or countries of, you know, a special devotion of one kind or another. What's the downside for the U.S. here?
Well, the downside is that it's damaged American interests in the Middle East and more generally around the world. Just to give you two examples, by supporting Israeli policy in the occupied territories, especially Israel's brutal treatment of the Palestinians, the United States has done great damage to its reputation in the Arab and Islamic world. And at the same time, it has helped fuel the terrorism problem. Furthermore, it's quite clear that the lobby played a key role, not the sole role, but played a key role in pushing the United States to war against Iraq. And Iraq has turned into one of the greatest strategic blunders in American history, and this obviously is not good for the United States. I would add, Tom, that the policies that we pursue in the Middle East are not only not good for the United States, they're not good for Israel. It would have been much better for Israel if, starting in 1967, when the Israelis captured the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, if the United States had pursued a hardline policy on the settlements and told the Israelis that they could not try to colonize the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It would have been better for Israel, and of course it would have been better for the United States as well.
There's the argument, or the beginning of it. Yesterday we heard Abe Foxman, head of the Anti-Defamation League, call this argument defamation. We'll come back and ask about that. We will hear in this hour from Ambassador Dennis Ross and Aaron David Miller, longtime State Department key player on the Middle East. John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt are with us. Their new book is The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. You can join the conversation. Have you heard the furious uproar over Walt and Mearsheimer's case? Does this sound like brave truth-telling to you or like defamation? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
On Point continues here on Iowa Public Radio. Major funding for On Point is from Liberty Mutual. For auto, home, life, and business insurance needs, Liberty Mutual, responsibility, what's your policy? And from Stonehill College, where many minds gather for one purpose, to educate students for lives that make a difference, near Boston in Easton, Massachusetts. Stonehill.edu. Mostly sunny again today here in Iowa, hot and humid, highs today 85 to 95 degrees, temperatures now in the 70s, mostly sunny skies, 19 past 9. Support for AM 910 Iowa Public Radio comes from the University of Iowa College of Dentistry, celebrating 125 years of educating dentists for Iowa and for the nation. Information about their array of services on the web at dentistry.uiowa.edu. And from Willowen School in Iowa City, an independent school with preschool through 8th grade, now located at their new campus, enrolling for fall, limited space available. Daily tour is available to the public. Information at willowen.org or 338-6061. Sunny and 76 degrees, 20 past 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with scholars Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer about their controversial new book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which charges U.S. national security has been damaged and U.S. foreign policy steered wrong by a powerful Israel lobby in America. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is there a problem in the U.S. relationship with Israel? Is there a problem with the way that relationship is influenced with the way we discuss it? And have Walt and Mearsheimer fallen into dangerous old ways of thinking here, or are they saying something urgent and true? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Yesterday, on NPR's Fresh Air, talking with Terry Gross, Anti-Defamation League ADL head Abe Foxman went on the attack, as he has heavily. He's come out with a book in opposition to Walt and Mearsheimer's work. Here he argues that their criticism, and Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, I want to get your response here, that your criticism taps into a dark vein in European history.
There is, unfortunately, Terry, a history that this plugs into. And that is, not to be overdramatic, but when Hitler began his anti-Semitic campaigns, he did not begin with Aryan supremacy. Hitler charged the Jews as being not loyal Germans, putting their own interests above the interests of the German people, selling out Germany's interests, bringing Germany to its knees, and therefore they don't deserve to live, et cetera, et cetera. When Stalin began his anti-Semitic campaign, it was that the Jews were not loyal Soviets. They didn't have the interest of the Soviet Union, of communism. They had an interest of Zionism. This is what this plugs into.
There, Abe Foxman, head of the ADL. Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, you write that the response to the essay that preceded this book was breathtaking. Elliot Abrams called your paper anti-Semitic, Alan Dershowitz as well. George Shultz, very critical of it. And not only those two, David Gergen and others. You hear Abe Foxman there saying, he called it defamation. And he says, in effect, whatever your intent, this feeds into an old, what he is called a canard about Jewish sort of behind-the-scenes power that feeds anti-Semitism. What's your response?
I'd say a couple of things. First of all, this is the standard tactic that people like Mr. Foxman have been using for years to try and make it virtually impossible or at least very dangerous for anyone to utter anything even slightly critical of Israel or certainly critical of groups that support Israel in the United States or push a pro-Israeli policy in the United States. And they do this by charging, first by smearing people in various ways, and most importantly by misrepresenting what they say. So if you listen to the Foxman passage that you just played there, it's essentially a guilt by association, right? He's trying to link us to Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
But the history of anti-Semitism is real and is a shameful mark on history. Do you not fear that this could feed into it, whatever your assessment of Abe Foxman's analysis?
The history of anti-Semitism is despicable, and we make this abundantly clear in the book where we condemn it openly. And we point out all of the ways in which our argument is completely different from those various charges. People like Foxman argue that we think the lobby is all-powerful. We don't. We say it's not. We don't say that the lobby controls American foreign policy. But again, they're attempting to misrepresent our argument to make us sound like we're just a new version of these old anti-Semitic arguments. You'll note he brought up the issue about loyalty. We make it abundantly clear that we think people who lobby on Israel's behalf are loyal Americans. We don't question their patriotism one bit. We argue that it's completely legitimate for people in the United States to lobby on behalf of whatever political interests they may have. And in fact, in the United States, you're allowed to have dual citizenship. You're even allowed to serve in foreign armies. So again, when you can't defeat our arguments, defeat the substance of our arguments, I think you're only left with two things. You either have to misrepresent those arguments, which has been widespread, or you have to try and smear us. Much the same way, by the way, Jimmy Carter was smeared when he published his book last year. The man who had done more for Middle East peace than just about anybody in history, had done more to make Israel more secure. Nonetheless, when he writes a book that's critical of the occupation, he's also smeared for being an anti-Semite sympathetic to Nazism. It's unfortunate.
Tom, I want to ask you a question. Are you saying that because of the history of anti-Semitism, that we cannot here in the United States criticize Israeli policy, and that we cannot point out that there is a lobby and that this lobby has an influence on Israeli foreign policy? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not making a case. I'm asking a question, but there is a lot of history behind all of us here, and I'm merely asking if you feel the weight and presence
that
of that
nobody
history as you
that
make your
for
analysis.
One second. I want to be very clear on this. Both Steve and I understand the history of anti-Semitism very well, and we went to great lengths to make it clear in the article that we wrote, and certainly in the book that we have now written, that we are aware of this history and that we are not making arguments that bear any resemblance to those sorts of arguments you read in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
We're going to hear interest group politics here. We're going to hear in
and
just a moment.
What the Israel lobby is doing is no different than what the National Rifle Association and the AARP are doing. And we can talk about the NRA and we can talk about the AARP, and there is no reason that we can't talk about the Israel lobby, especially when the consequences of its actions are so important for U.S. policy in the Middle East.
Let's go to a very high-profile example as you see it. You are very straightforward when it comes to the Iraq War. You say that the Israel lobby, especially the neoconservatives within it, was a principal driving force behind the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq in 2003. You say, but for the lobby's influence, there almost certainly would not have been this war. Stephen Walt, that's a big and hot charge, given how difficult this war has become. How do you justify it?
Well, first of all, the whole idea of invading Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein originates with the neoconservatives. You can't find other groups within the United States who are pushing this, and they begin pushing it back in the late 1990s. The important thing to note here, of course, though, is that they were unable to persuade the Clinton administration to favor a war, and they were unable to persuade the Bush administration, in particular President Bush, to support going to war to overthrow Saddam Hussein until September 11th. So we don't argue that the lobby is solely responsible. We argue it was a critical element. Another critical element, of course, was
the principal driving force, you say. That's not solely responsible, but that is a large claim.
Absolutely. And again, Tom Friedman of the New York Times was quoted in Haaretz as saying that, look, if there are 25 people here in Washington who, if you'd exiled them to a desert island a few years ago, the war in Iraq would not have happened. That's not me saying it. That was Tom Friedman saying it.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you, and we're going to bring Ambassador Dennis Ross in for just a moment. Let me go to one call first. Shalom, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shalom, you're on the air.
Hi. I do not care if the authors are anti-Semitic or not. I think it's barking up the wrong tree.
Okay.
I care very much about their dismissing in half a sentence the what happened in Munich in 1938 when Czechoslovakia, whose safety was guaranteed by Great Britain and France, was sold down the river to Hitler. And Chamberlain came with a piece of paper, agreement with Hitler, said, I brought you peace with honor in our time. And Churchill said, you already lost your honor. You're going to lose your peace. And within less than a year, a World War II broke out.
Do you see Israel being sold down the river here, Shalom?
No, but the authors, in effect, their intentions may be the best. They're leading all the way to possible nuclear holocaust and hell. They're not discussing seriously what the president of Iran said. They're dismissing that one too in one sentence. He didn't mean it or mistranslated destruction of Israel. They are very cavalier from the Olympian academic heights. They don't address the issue that this, what would be perceived by the enemies of Israel, the 300 or 350 Arabs and over a billion Muslims, most of them hostile to Israel, they'll not take that seriously, that their advice in the chapter with the last heading borrowed from Lenin, what's to be done, is abandonment of Israel, which will be a signal of attack, which will lead to World War III, very likely. They ignore it.
Shalom, thank you for your call. I want to leave that observation hanging there for just a moment. We will return to it. But let me turn right now, if I may, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, to Ambassador Dennis Ross. He joins us from Scottsdale, Arizona today. He served in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton as chief negotiator and advisor on Mideast affairs, currently a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ambassador Ross, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here today.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
You have debated Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer on their thesis. We'll look at some details, but give us your broad response first to what the case they're making in the Israel lobby.
Well, they know I've never accused them of being anti-Semitic, and that's not the tack I take in looking at what they've written. I do think that they are highly, highly ideological, and I think they also don't allow reality to intrude into what is their ideological theory.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that I've got a book out now on statecraft, and statecraft is about how you marry your objectives and your means and how you do reality-based assessments to shape those objectives and means. This administration, the Bush administration, has failed in statecraft. It hasn't failed because somehow the Israel lobby has pushed them into a war. They have failed because they don't define objectives clearly. They don't identify means clearly. They use ideology to shape their objectives and their means, and they don't let the facts confuse them. Now, take a look at what you were asking about the whole issue of Iraq, and the quote is, the principal driving force, the lobby was the principal driving force. You can quote Tom Friedman in Haaretz and talk about 25 people. If you had a different president, if Al Gore had been president and not George Bush, we would not have gone to war, whether there was an Israeli lobby or not an Israeli lobby.
What about your experience? You've been in the wheelhouse of U.S. policy when it comes to the Middle East, Israel, and the Palestinians. Did you see direct kind of intervention, influence, you know, sort of overwhelming guidance, steering by an Israel lobby?
Of course not. There's also a division here that one has to draw. The impact that the Israel lobby has in the Congress is one thing. The impact that it has on the executive branch administrations is something very different. I won't say that there were never times when I would have to fly back from the Middle East and go to the Congress to justify or make a case for our policies because there had been lobbying on the Hill. But I will tell you, administrations that have to defend their policies, think through their policies, explain their policies, are actually stronger for having had to do it. So the fact is, there isn't a single time where we made a decision on the peace process because of the Israeli lobby. There isn't a single time that we shied away from making a decision on the peace process because of the Israeli lobby. Were we aware that there were voices out there and views out there? Of course. But the fact is, that's just not the way decisions are made. And I'm afraid that too much of what both John and Steve had written reflects too much detachment from the way policy is actually made.
Stephen Walt, how about it? So you've got a thesis. Dennis Ross doesn't see the facts on the ground to support it.
Well, you know, we obviously disagree about this one. I'd remind, I guess, Dennis, that you know, Bill Clinton said that AIPAC was stunningly effective, better than anyone else lobbying in this town. And Newt Gingrich, who didn't agree with Bill Clinton on very much, said it was the most effective general interest group across the entire planet. Lee Hamilton, who served in Congress for 34 years, said there's no lobby group that matches it. Now,
is effective bad? Does that equal something negative? Effective?
Well, as I've said, as we've said before, this is a very powerful constraining force on any president, and certainly, as Dennis just conceded, has a tremendous impact in Congress. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why you saw that throughout the Oslo peace process that Dennis was intimately involved with. Although the United States was clearly interested in trying to bring the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to a close, throughout that entire period, Israel doubled the size of the population occupying the West Bank, and the United States did nothing to stop it. We never made our aid conditional. We never told the Israelis that if they didn't stop building settlements and didn't stop expanding it, that we would start reducing our support. And that suggests that there's something constraining American politicians from doing what needs to be done in order to bring about a peace that would be good for Israelis and good for Palestinians alike, and, of course, very good for the United States.
Let me say, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dennis Ross, your response?
I would like to respond to that. Maybe if the two of you had done more time actually talking to people who were in administrations making policies, you would have a better feel for this. We didn't crack down on the issue of settlements because of the Israeli lobby. I'd be the first to tell you we should have taken a tougher posture. The reason we didn't take a tougher posture is because Yitzhak Rabin said to us, I don't have the political support to take on this issue as well. Don't push me too hard on this. This is someone who also said, there are limits to how much I can do. He was also assassinated by someone who came out of the whole national settler movement. Barack, when we were talking to him at the when in advance of Camp David and afterwards, he said, look, I'm prepared to get out of almost all of the West Bank. Don't push me too hard on the settlements. Now, the fact is, we listened to them. Maybe we shouldn't have. My own view in retrospect is that we should have taken a different posture on the settlement issue because of the impact it would have not only on the Israelis, but also on the Palestinians. But that was a judgment we made. Maybe the judgment was wrong, but it wasn't because the Israeli lobby was affecting us. That's why I say, maybe you should have not just looked at what political people will say when they speak to AIPAC, but also talk to people in administrations and ask them specifically, why did you make the decisions you make when you did them?
So, Dennis Ross, when Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer write that many policies pursued on Israel's behalf now jeopardize U.S. national security, do you agree?
You know, I don't. I mean, you wouldn't know when you listen to them that Israel withdrew unilaterally from Lebanon, you wouldn't know when you listen to them that Israel withdrew unilaterally from Gaza. In each case, Hezbollah claimed violence worked, diplomacy didn't. Hamas claimed violence worked, diplomacy didn't. Israeli unilateral moves were, in fact, a sign of weakness. The fact of the matter is, the Israelis are not always right. We should have had a different posture last summer on Lebanon. But the reality is also that they're living in a world that is a difficult world. When you read this book, what you find is they're pretty indifferent to the problems the Israelis face. Now, the fact is, when you negotiate peace, you actually have to be able to focus on the problems that both sides have. You have to meet the needs of both sides. I'm afraid that, you know, from the standpoint of a policymaker and from the standpoint of statecraft, when you're trying to marry objectives and means, the key is to do a reality-based assessment that takes into account the needs of all sides.
Ambassador Dennis Ross, chief negotiator and advisor on Middle East affairs under President H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, author of the new book, Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. Ambassador Ross, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
John Mearsheimer, just a few seconds before the break, but your response?
Well, we're not indifferent to Israel's interests, but of course we're mainly concerned about the American national interest because we are Americans. And our argument is that these policies that the United States is pursuing largely on behalf of Israel are not in Israel's national interest or in the American national interest.
And there's the case, there's the response. When we come back, we'll hear from Aaron David Miller, who an advisor to six secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations. Take your calls and hear more from Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer. Their new book is The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Has the U.S. been led astray by an Israel lobby? Why aren't we talking about the Irish lobby or the Cuban lobby or the Saudi lobby? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
On Point continues. Major funding for On Point is provided by the construction site, offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And from RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles. 617-859-0540. The exchange coming up at 10, and right now, sunshine in all areas except for the extreme southwest, temperatures in the 70s, and a hot and humid day today in Iowa, highs 85 to 95.
First date, new romance, different partner, same.
I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change is the title of a play filled with music and humor set to hit the stage at Iowa City's Riverside Theater. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wednesday on The Exchange, we'll get a preview. Also, author and Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Kate Christensen joins us to talk about her new novel, The Great Man, the tale of a famous American artist known for his endless troubles with women. Join The Exchange Wednesday morning at 10.
939 support for AM 910 comes from the Northwest Area Foundation, providing support for coverage of issues related to poverty and poverty reduction. Information about the Northwest Area Foundation at nwaf.org. And from the Java House, providing an atmosphere for personal reading, conversation with friends, or a business meeting, featuring mugs of cocoa with fresh whipped cream and Ghirardelli caramel lattes. The Java House, with 7 locations in Iowa City. Mostly sunny today in eastern Iowa, high in the upper 80s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms, low in the upper 60s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Thursday's high in the low 80s.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with scholars Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer. Stephen Walt of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, about their new book, The Israel Lobby. It charges that U.S. national security has been damaged and U.S. foreign policy steered wrong by a powerful Israel lobby in America. You can join the conversation. Can we have a more open discussion about this without having an anti-Semitic discussion? 800-423-8255 is our number. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's take a call. Jeffrey in Des Moines, Iowa, you're on the air.
Through satellite TV, much of the world sees the United States through the prism of our support of Israel's occupation. And to buttress the professor's point, you know, if you look at United Nations resolutions, even that simply call for Israel to abide by the Geneva Conventions, the resolutions are typically vetoed by the United States, and in the General Assembly, the votes are usually about 180-2 with the U.S. and Israel on the other side. Another quick evidence of the power of AIPAC in Congress, when's the last time you heard a Republican or Democrat even use the word occupation or say something as simple as Israel has nuclear weapons? Last, I'll say, don't look now, but AIPAC, with both money and suits in Washington, is pushing our country to use force against Iran.
Let's pick those up. Jeffrey, and thanks for your call. Stephen Walt, first to you on the congressional influence point. Dennis Ross concedes some of that. You quote in the book Stephen Rosen, former AIPAC official, later indicted for allegedly passing classified government documents to Israel. Talking with the New Yorker's Jeffrey Goldberg, he put a napkin in front of Goldberg and said, in 24 hours, we could have the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin. How do you assess the impact of the lobby as you see it on congressional policy?
Well, it's quite clear that Israel is essentially immune from criticism on Capitol Hill. As the caller suggested, you're just not going to find congressmen who are willing to jeopardize their own careers. And the reason they're worried, of course, is if they get the reputation for being slightly critical of Israel, they run the risk that AIPAC and other groups will start trying to direct campaign contributions towards potential contenders. There are a number of famous cases where AIPAC has targeted congressmen or senators and driven them from office. Now, they don't succeed every time they try, obviously, but most people on Capitol Hill have gotten the message that this just isn't worth doing. And I should add, this is, again, the way sort of interest group politics in the United States works. If you've got an interest group that's well organized and works 24/7 on an issue, and the rest of the population doesn't care as much about the issue, they can have a disproportionate impact. I would just add one other point. The caller mentioned the possibility of a war with Iran. Mm. Now, I want to be clear. First of all, the American Jewish population was less supportive of going to war in Iraq than the American people as a whole, so you shouldn't see that as something that was due to Jewish influence. And I would say the same thing about a war, possible military action against Iran. But it's quite clear that many of the same groups and individuals that were pushing us to go after Saddam Hussein back in 2002, 2003, have been leading the charge for us to take some kind of military action against Iran as well, and making many of the same arguments. And again, I think it would have many of the same negative consequences if they were to succeed.
The argument's been made that, Iran is Israel's greater fear. So if the Israel lobby were so powerful, why would the U.S. have gone into Iraq? That's not the number one Israeli concern. Is there a contradiction then, John, in you having described Iraq as the result of Israeli lobby influence?
No, Tom. It's quite clear that in early 2002, now remember we went into Iraq in March 2003. In early 2002, when the Israelis caught wind of the fact that we were seriously thinking about doing Iraq, that they came to Washington and told us that they would prefer that we do Iran first. The Israelis very clearly thought that Iran was a greater threat than Iraq. It's not that they were uninterested in having us effect regime change in Iraq and Syria. It's just that they preferred Iran. But once they came to understand that Iraq would be the first operation and we would subsequently deal with Iran and Syria, they embraced the idea of attacking Iraq, although they continually reminded us that we had to do Iran and Syria afterwards. So what you see from early 2002 up until the war starts in March 2003 is that the Israelis are pushing us very hard, harder than any other country outside the United States, to go to war against Saddam Hussein.
Let's go to Marla in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Marla, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I welcome the debate and open discussion that the Walter Mearsheimer book has raised, but I was wondering if they would comment on a different criticism of their book, which comes from people who share their criticism of Israeli policy, which is to say, what about the oil interests? Why is it set up that the pro-Israel lobby is the power broker and not the oil interests in terms of U.S. policy.
Stephen Walt?
There's no question that oil is a vital American strategic interest, which is why the United States wants to prevent any hostile power from, say, taking over the Persian Gulf. But if you look carefully at it, it turns out that the energy lobby or the oil lobby doesn't have much impact on American Middle East policy. The oil companies, for example, opposed sanctions against Iran and against Iraq. In fact, Dick Cheney, when he was head of Halliburton, opposed the sanctions policy against Iran and complained that it was keeping American oil companies from making money in places like Iran. Oil companies, they care about things like environmental regulations, tax policy, whether they're going to get drilling leases in key places. They have not tended to drive things in terms of foreign policy. And this has been conceded, by the way, by a number of AIPAC officials who've said openly that they really don't face much opposition from the oil lobby. In fact, Doug Bloomfield, who was AIPAC's legislative head, told BBC News in 2002 that they had one great advantage at AIPAC, which was simply that they didn't have much opposition. So again, the oil lobby, many people think, is very important, but if it were driving American policy in the Middle East, you'd see a very different policy than what we've had the last couple of decades.
Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer, stand by. And Marla, thank you for your call. I want to bring another voice into this conversation. Joining us from Portland, Maine, is Aaron David Miller. He was an advisor to six U.S. Secretaries of State on Arab-Israeli negotiations between 1978 and 2003. He's currently a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, author of the book on U.S. Middle East policy coming out next spring entitled America and the Much-Too-Promised Land, The Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. Aaron David Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You've also been right in the thick of this. You've seen the argument that Mearsheimer and Walt make. As somebody who's been right in the heart of it, do you agree with their assessment of what's gone on, what's going on?
It's a tough issue, and it's a tough issue to get right. First of all, you need a lot of honesty, clarity, and a lot of courage, particularly in a post-9/11 world, to do it, because the stakes for America, as the two professors point out, are very high. Listening over the past 45 minutes, however, I'm not sure that either the two professors nor my colleague, Dennis Ross, really has gotten it right. Based on 20 years of working in the system and over 160 interviews that I've done for my forthcoming book, The Much Too Promised Land, with our former presidents, secretaries of state, evangelicals, congressmen, senators, American Jews, Arabs, you really have to talk to the lobbied and the lobbyists in order to understand the real impact of domestic politics. I think the two professors have attached too much importance to domestic politics as a force on America's Middle East policy.
By domestic politics, do you mean the Israel lobby or something?
I mean the pro-Israeli community, which, as you know, is no longer simply the purview or the property of 5.3 million American Jews. It now extends to millions of evangelical Christians and millions of Americans who, over time, have come to identify with Israel. Frankly, most Americans don't care about this issue, but in a post-9/11 world, frankly, public opinion polling continues to support the notion that value affinity is still very much a part of the foundation on which the lobby and the pro-Israeli community base their arguments.
It's kind of a moral identification, a political identification.
You can call it moral. I call it value affinity. The perception, rightly or wrongly, that the Israelis are more or less like us. And in the post-9/11 world, democracies under the threat of suicide terror,